So, we're about to start our last session, but before we do, I wanted to take just a moment to thank the ITP staff who have really made this a marvelous conference for all of us. There's Doreen, there's Monica. There's Deborah. And then there's Maggie. And
we have to do it this way, so I can go on by. We wanted to say to you how very much all of us at the conference, and I think particularly the organizers, rely on all of you. Make the sort of thing that we try to do at ITP really work, so that people who come can enjoy the physics and the organizers can enjoy the conference, and somehow it runs. And so it's very special. I want to thank Paris and Greg and Kevin. I'm afraid they saw I had no flowers. And they left. They're the people who helped make the equipment run here and have helped all of us at different times get view graphs, to things up on the computer. And I will go find and thank them later. And then from the organizers, from Bob, from Patrick, from myself, Catherine.
All right. Yeah,
for us here, Catherine. It's been marvelous, and I'm not going to even bring you this bucket, so pour your flowers until we figure out something better. Thank you very much. Morris, it's all yours.
Okay. Well, we've come to the last session, which is supposed to wrap up this conference and discuss issues, open questions, and future directions. Now, in all of these discussion sessions that we've had before, the chairman has put up a list of questions, so I'm going to put up a short list here, but up till now, the speakers have not paid much attention, I've noticed, to the issues and questions, but hopefully this time you will pay a little more. And I have lots of empty view graphs here, so the speakers want to add more. There's certainly plenty of room. So these questions came also partly from talking to Sudeep Chakrabarty, Bill Anderson, and others. So first question I have down there is the phase diagram, the exact form, what sort of quantum critical points do we have? And of course, we've had a lot of discussion, particularly from the form that Bill Norum proposed at the meeting. Second question and topic I have here is spin charge separation and our topological order. Does it exist? And if it exists, where in the phase diagram? And particularly important question, we've had a very nice proposal from Senthil for an experiment. Is that a definitive test? Is it a realistic experiment? Then, of course, another topic, and this one apparently was the hot topic at the Trieste meeting a few weeks ago. Stripes, are they the cure for the ITC problem, or are they disease? So this was apparently the number one topic voted at the Trieste meeting. The last three are more theoretical. What is the minimum model that we need to describe the ITC? Secondly, is there an insulating ground state with odd number of electrons per unit cell? Does that does not break spin or translational symmetry, and is it and related question, one that I was discussing earlier, is a truncation of the Fermi surface possible without this? And lastly, the role of phonons in long-range Coulomb interaction. These are topics actually which were basically not discussed. Actually, now that I look at the list, I see I've left one off. Another question would be, what are the factors that govern the systematics of TC? Like, what is the role of multi-layer compounds versus single-layer compounds? What distinguishes the different values of TC in the different families, group rate families? What are the key parameters that distinguish them? I will add this on as number 7. But okay, so that's the list of questions and issues that I've come up with, and the speakers that we have to address these questions in this session and add maybe there more are from experiment, Herb Mook, Dale Van Haringen, and Juan Ong. The experimentalists go first. We all know that nowadays there's a convergence between condensed matter physics, experimentalism, and particle physics, and working on big machines, etc. And a former colleague of mine at Zurich used to maintain that the key signature of a particle physicist experimentalist was that they always had to leave right after the seminar for the airport. So we have put these up here because some of these are also leaving for the airport. But then we come to three theory speakers. These are three of the organizers. I've tried to get the fourth one, but Catherine didn't want to join, so there's no discrimination here. I want to assure you, no discrimination when having only three of the four organizers, Doug, Patrick, and Bob. And I chose the order so as to put Bob here as the heaviest slugger in the field, in the cleanup hitter position here, in the hope that he will clean up this field, which is a major achievement, Bob, if you can do that. Okay, so maybe we should get started then, and the first speaker is Herr Buch from Oak Ridge. Oh, I don't care.
Hey, Mark, put your questions back up.
Yeah, I will. I put it up. I don't just add that last one. I forgot to put on. I'll put them back up.
Well, I don't really know what to say in this session. Furthermore, I've got to follow Bertram. Makes me feel kind of like the guy who survived the Johnstown flood. There actually was a flood in Pennsylvania in the 20s. Pretty serious people died in this flood. But there's one guy who survived, and he didn't have much claim to fame other than that. And he began to tell stories about how he survived the Johnstown flood. And of course, as he grew older, he embellished these stories, and it was a great, wonderful for him to tell these, and he enjoyed them. But like us all, he died and went wherever we go, say to heaven or to some such place, and the gatekeeper recognized him right away. And he said, "Oh, you're the guy who likes to tell the stories about the Johnstown flood." And he said he was really pleased by that. And the gatekeeper said, "Well, we have story sessions here in heaven as well, you know, and we'd be glad. In fact, we have one tonight. And as a matter of fact, we'll put you on right after Noah." Okay. To be serious, I guess. Let me go.
Stop there.
Okay. Well, what are we going to do in neutron scattering, and how can we address somebody's questions? We have to, in neutron scattering, take seriously Bob's and Chuck Gavardi's current loop business, right? I mean, that's a serious proposal, and I think they made a real mistake, actually, in this, because Chandra had a current loop proposal, and his is uncheckable, actually, because his current loop is spelled at the Bragg reflections of the reciprocal lattice, and therefore unseeable, but in fact,
Bob's and Patrick's Ball, where you can see them. They call it Pi Pi, more or less, with some C-axis variation. And I believe that people can actually look for these, and if the moments are like we might expect them to be, they're seeable, perhaps.
No. Okay.
At least Bob's are, I think. Yours are fluctuating. They're harder.
Even this, the moment is...
It's 10 Gauss.
Yeah.
That's seeable. That's seeable. So I think the neutron people will go out and look for those. It's really 10 Gauss.
You know, we don't... I just
multiplied
my estimate to 5.
So unless Bob, we don't see it, the estimate goes to 1 or 100%. But I think that can be done. I think we can get an answer to that, Bob. But I'd like to talk to the men about strikes and the resonance. We have these boundaries which Jean Transwada, I think, and others have made famous. I think John saw them first, certainly. And we have these strikes and we have anti-phase domains across the holes. And I've just drawn a set of 4 here. And these strikes give, as we've all seen, incommensurate peaks around pi pi. That's made it very simple in one dimension, which are the spin peaks. And around the reciprocal lattice of the crystal itself, where the charge is, after all, charge is part of the crystal, we see charge peaks at twice the wave vector spacing of these peaks. And those are clearly there. But then there's been some interesting experiments at very low doping. Ando actually mentioned one down in the area where we looked about 6.35, and they see very interesting, in fact, they see hysteresis loops down there. Perhaps ferromagnetism, and then wonders if there aren't then these kind of domains, where you don't have anti-phase domains across the boundary, you have in-phase domains across the boundary. And so we want to look for these things, and the signature of these things is, of course, you see a charge peak now, which we have seen in static case, around the reflections of the main lattice, of the crystal lattice, that are charge-like. But you notice now the unit cell now is the same for both charge and spin. And so you should see ferromagnetic peaks in this simple model at the same place as the charge peaks are. And we found them. Actually, they're there. So that's a whole new ball game now. I talked to Steve Kibbleson the other day, and there may be other versions of this where you dimerize that and get something like this. But nevertheless, now we have a whole new ball game to think about. And it turns out, as you go out to higher and higher doping, you find that there's a whole set of magnetic fluctuations that not are found around pi pi, but are found around 0, 0, if you like, or 2 pi, 2 pi, that we really haven't investigated before. And these have an entirely different behavior. In fact, they follow much the behavior of the pseudogap, as opposed to these other kind of peaks down here, which may or may not follow PC. Bob Virginos got a beautiful case where they do follow PC, but that's not always apparently the case. So one nice thing about this, of course, is these boundaries is, first of all, they make the resonance. The scattering at pi now comes is commensurate. So these phase boundaries give you the resonance. So that's certainly one way to get the resonance out of strikes in a kind of straightforward way. Second of all, the simulation showed that these things like superconductivity, these kind of fakes in some way. So I make this conjecture just to kind of throw this open, this complete craziness, just to kind of end up the session. That maybe these things are the things that are giving us the real action. And while we've been spending all our time measuring these things, these boundaries, that things like that or dimerized versions of something like that really give you are the ones that count. And so we've been busy measuring the spin fluctuations from these things, which in turn also show up at the commensurate point of pi pi, and certainly that's the field that I'd like to follow. So maybe we've been measuring the wrong ones the whole time, or maybe not. But nevertheless, I think that's the direction that this new set of spin fluctuations is very interesting, and certainly we'd like to pursue it. Well, I have almost no more to say about that, except that this has been a wonderful conference. I've enjoyed certainly talking to everybody here. The organizers have done a great job. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks. Thank you all.
Or in this general topic of scattering experiments, that few issues that other people want to bring up, add to this one. Yes?
So Herb, if this proposal is true,
yeah,
then why would you simultaneously see both?
Well, you have to have both kinds, sure, in the system. Clearly, these kinds are there because we see the anti-theta domains in these peaks around pi-pi, but we also, you know, have to have both kinds. And maybe these are bad for superconductivity, but maybe these are good. Okay, after all, the simulations show that superconductivity likes those. And so if I had a theory of superconductivity, I would say, you know, just completely off the wall. But, hey, you know, I can make superconductivity out of stripes with these things. Okay, and not only that, I can make the resonance out of these things.
Just mention one thing. I mean, these are very simple pictures in which,
yeah,
you have the stars,
sure,
of which are one atomic unit.
Yeah.
And in that particular case, of course, the above picture, for example, the anti-phase,
right,
boundaries, they would mean in the simple picture that you would never want to end the strike. The strike would have to be infinitely long, otherwise,
yeah,
it costs you an infinite amount of energy,
yeah,
to stop it. Okay. So one way of stopping it is to have, in fact, these other stripes,
right,
they can easily be stopped.
You have to draw this in two dimensions, and
yeah,
you have to work out the actual structure factors, and I've done that, actually. And
these anti-phase ones can stop on the two of them coming together.
Yes, the way they can stop is by making closed loops of some sort.
Yes,
be it,
yes,
yes.
And
but,
for example, in
the, yeah,
parametric chart, thanks to the system, when you pull them on, you see exactly all these loops all the time.
Yeah. Then they really become, I would like to have, for the anti-phase boundaries, I would like to have more closed loops, actually, than stripes,
yeah,
be it that,
oh,
way.
Oh, you know, stripes may not be it. Any discontinuity, any boundaries.
Yes.
You know, maybe stripes are not it, but some boundary in the system,
yeah,
is what gives you the superconductivity in this sort of scenario.
In the second situation there, you should also observe weaker incommensurate peaks as well, right? Do you see that?
Around pi-pi?
Yeah.
Yes, you should. Of course, they're much weaker if you work out the structure factors. But they should be there. We haven't seen them, but they are a lot weaker than the incommensurate ones, which are not too strong to begin with. But you're right. Of course, you could see not only the strikes, not only these, of course, but then little bits of, you know, from on the sides of those. So that's, of course, another thing to check. That's a hard place to look because these are already there. It appears clean. There's nothing else can be here, you know, except the charge piece.
Herb, we've talked a lot in this meeting about looking for various kinds of order, and the first kind of order that came up several years ago is U, was described.
Yeah.
Now we have many more mechanical distortions we're talking about, including the pneumatic state. Let's see, what I'd like is to elicit a comment about how feasible searching for these other mechanical orders is given the material situation.
What do you call them mechanical?
Well, because the atoms will
tell.
Thus,
it would help to move, right?
What?
It would help to move you if they don't drive.
That's right. So, for example,
what kind of order? Like a pneumatic order?
Well, the pneumatic order would show up, I think this is right, Steve, there's a shortening of the lattice in one direction, which means that in a practical system, the Bragg point split.
Right.
Okay. And there are lots of ways of searching for different kinds of atomic ordering that we could imagine as theorists, but there are practical experimental limitations. So my question is, what's the future to be for theories? What's of challenging theories that have new kinds of order?
Well, as we talked about, these systems are never pure. I mean, maybe the 412, what is it, the 8, 412, 8 compound or whatever, but perhaps some of them are pure. or even Bob, you know, Bob and his assistant, he thought was rather clear, but in general, these are sloppy things. And so we have glassing stations, more or less all over, in some degrees. We have no infinite way to arrange phase transitions, if that's what you're after, but you can surely see signatures of these various states. You can see, if you see, we've seen quite a long range order already, more or less static order for the very unbuilt side of the phase diagram, I think. I had an experiment where I took a single domain sample and found that in a single domain sample, the stripes went in one direction. Okay, that breaks symmetry, clearly. That's the next phase over. Now, whether you eventually get to a, completely rotationally invariant phase at high doping and things like that, I think you can find these states in that sense.
Another possibility is to look for systems which are more desirable and therefore more symmetric and look for the signatures in systems that don't have any intrinsic symmetry.
Yes.
Like the mercury compounds.
I think the one layer mercury compounds, which have high TCs and are simple, are really the way to go. You know, if we had crystals of these things, we could really go. But anybody that has these, let me know.
Yeah, I just had one. Actually, it was a comment on the stripes. When we draw these nice pictures, it's actually not true that the stripes are topological excitations, because the spins aren't Ising spins.
Yeah. Sure.
And so they can end. If you add some of the stripes that Subir was talking about, where you would have a domain wall in a dimer order, which would be Ising, those would be true topological.
Our momentary supplementary indicates that the stripes are probably coupled with the line field. And this in-phase stripes allows that possibility because if you count the number of up spins, the number is larger than the number of down spins.
Right.
So naturally, these in-phase stripes are coupled to the line field.
So at the very low doping end, that agrees beautifully with what you see.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. All right. I agree with Herb here that it's not easy to figure out what to talk about at a session like this. Let me just add my appreciation to the organizers, particularly Catherine, for having this meeting. It's been very well organized, very stimulating, and the chance to come to a place like this is particularly welcome when you live in Urbana. So certainly glad to be here. When Catherine asked me if I would speak here, she told me I should think about the key issues and then describe what are the definitive experiments to resolve those. And with all these talented experimentalists here, the one thing I can assure you of, if I knew the definitive experiment, I certainly wouldn't talk about it here. So since I don't, I will promise you, what I did instead was on the way out here on the plane, I made a list of five things that I thought were interesting questions, probably pretty much biased by my own interests and things that I think that what I do can contribute to this problem. And I thought that during the meeting I would cross off the ones that had been resolved and add some more. Well, none of them were resolved, so I'm going to go with those five and talk just a little bit about not really specific experiments so much as the kind of experiments I think that and kind of topics that I think are interesting. And then at the end I have one question I'd like to raise that is something that has been nagging me about D-Wave for a long time. So, okay, so here's some just sort of rambling thoughts here. The things that I am kind of intrigued about with this problem is the unconventional superconductivity, particularly the symmetry, and the unconventional nature of the normal phases, in particular things that you can access by perhaps looking at mesoscopic length scales. So one thing I think I'm very interested in, of course, is the pairing symmetry of unconventional superconductors in general. We've developed, all of us, I think, a large set of tools for looking at unconventional superconductors. Both phase-sensitive things and spectroscopic things and transport things. But the bottom line is that at this point, I think there's only one unconventional superconductor set that we actually know the symmetry of, and that is, in fact, the cuprates, where I think we agree it's all dx squared minus y squared. But there's a lot of other interesting superconductors that are not high TC that the issue of symmetry has really come up. And we talked, there's something that didn't come up much at this meeting, the organic superconductor. I think there's a lot of evidence that it's D-wave, but that has not really been pinned down. The ruthenates, there's a lot of discussion here. This is an issue that I thought was close to being resolved. But now I think there is a lot of question about whether this complex PX plus IPY state is really the right description. Our own work and a lot of other groups have now reported nodes, so perhaps we're looking at a PX kind of state with nodes. And there's even, I think, some reasons to doubt or to question for sure whether or not this material is even P-wave at all. So, and then, of course, I think the most interesting material of all is the heavy fermions, where you have two-phase transitions. I think we all agree it's unconventional, but we haven't pinned down the symmetry yet. This is a material where the high temperature phase does not break time reversible symmetry. We think the low temperature phase does. And this is a fascinating system. Now, I think symmetry is an important issue because not only does it tell you about the mechanism, and I think an interesting thing is as we look at more complex systems, they're almost always coming out to be unconventional. So I think this connection between mechanism and symmetry is very interesting. But also from an application point of view, the symmetry is what really dictates largely how the properties behave in transport and interfaces and devices. A related issue that I'm, of course, also very interested in is what we call at Urbana the fragility of unconventional superconductors. That means that because of the phase anisotropy of all of these states, I think it has been fairly well established by work by Laura Green and other people that you have zero energy bound states form that suppresses the D wave or whatever the unconventional order parameter is. More controversial is whether or not it's possible then with the suppression of the D wave to have subdominant pairing mechanisms. This is one of those things that looked like was going to be there. Now in some experiments we see indications and lots of others we don't. So I think it's still a very open question whether or not these complex phases conform. And I think it's important to come up with experimental tests for looking at that. This is an interesting issue, I think, largely because it appears sort of everywhere. Everywhere you break the symmetry of the sample at surfaces, impurities, vortex cores. And I think the kind of probes that we've seen a lot of during this meeting that may be very useful are sort of local probes, tunneling locally, scanning squid microscope, magnetic probes, all kind of nanoscale things. These are really short length scale phenomenon. I think this is a fascinating issue to pursue. Now, the one that I hoped would not be on my list was what is the phase diagram. I thought that was going to be over. If I had a dollar for every phase diagram I've sketched in my notebook over the last 5 years or so, I'd be very rich. And it keeps changing. And I'm not sure I have anything much to offer here in the ways of my own experimental ideas for testing this. I think the real issue, I think, right now that John Lorem has certainly raised is this line here, the red line where it comes down to quantum critical point, is looking more and more like a real possibility. And I think there needs to be a lot of experiments to map out this diagram. I think Bob hit the problem right on the head with his last question. Was the real problem here, and is what it's going to be and has been forever in high TC, is can you get good enough samples to really make definitive statements? Because the interesting parts of this diagram, basically down here and up here, are regions where I think it's really hard to make homogeneous uniform samples. So I don't know the answer to the question Bob raised. Can we really tell whether we have ordered phases in certain structure because of the difficulties of the disorder? But I think if we don't know the phase diagram, it's hard for us experimentalists to know where to do experiments to map out what's going on in these sections. But to the extent that we do, one of the things I think is most interesting is this, I'll call it the pseudo-gap phase, but it may be something else, and the nature of the phase transitions. And I just mentioned a number of experiments here that I thought were raised at this meeting or a little bit before this meeting that I think are the right kind of experiments, where they really give an answer so far. This issue of what happens when you cross the pseudo-gap line, this idea now of whether it's a time-reversal symmetry breaking state, some interesting experiments that John Kirtley has done. I don't think he didn't talk about them here, but looking for time-reversal symmetry regions in the sample. Neil Polderak has data indicating that there may be magnetic things going on. I'm not saying those experiments say anything at this point, but they're the right kind of experiments, I think, to do to look at this section. The middle part here, I think something we're interested in, there's been a lot of nice work on looking at phase coherence effects. Joe Orenstein's very nice experiments looking for phase coherence. Fan Ong's experiments that he'll talk about more, I'm sure, about whether or not you have an indication of some kind of vortex coherence in this phase. again, the right kinds of experiments to do to really get microscopic information. I think the boundaries here have been mapped out largely by spectroscopies. It's time now for the microscopic measuring people, the STM people, the short length scale measurements to go in and really try to figure out microscopically what's going on. The other, of course, is the transition to the superconducting state. This idea of spin and charge, and I added in here the Vison separation. And it's already listed up there, this very intriguing experiment proposed by Sentil and Fisher to look for some real evidence for spin-charge separation, and the beautiful experiments that Louis Taillefer talked about in PCCO, which indicates something going on there. These are all the kinds of experiments I think we should do. The point I want to make is these are, I think, all short-range interactions. So where we're going to be looking, where I think a lot of people should look, is kind of developing local probes, looking on short length scales for these things. And the last topic, Herb already talked about a bit, which is stripes. Stripes are kind of a funny thing to me. I like the picture because I spent a long time working on superconductor arrays. So this idea of superconducting regions, phase coupling, very intriguing to me. I'm not learning much from stripes from kind of spectroscopies and things the way I look at it. I think maybe the stripes are too dynamic. Maybe they're going to be hard to pin down. But there are indications of static stripes, at least in some materials. And I think that gives rise to the possibility of doing experiments to either image them directly by STM or to do conduction experiments, perhaps with nanoscale techniques, to look directly at the conduction and the anisotropy of the transport. Because what you really want to know if there's a stripe is it adding to the conduction or is it impeding the superconductivity? So this is a real challenge because of finding the right materials, but it's a series of experiments that I think people are going to start looking at now that we're getting an idea of what materials show stripes and in what ranges.
I've done
that. Right?
I've done
it. You have done that, agreed. Over a large scale, right. So what I think I'm proposing now to do is to go in closer so that you can, instead of averaging out over large distances, you start to look at short length scales and see, you know, really tell more microscopically what's going on. So I agree, that's a good experiment. That's the kind of thing that I think needs to be done. There are a few transport experiments looking at stripes, so I thought yours was very interesting. Let me raise a question here that is, as most of you know, I'm a fairly strong believer in D-Wave. But something that has bothered me from really day one, if somebody asks me, what's the thing that really bothers you that makes you question this whole picture? It's the fact that we never see strongly formed gaps in D-Wave. Now, let me explain what I mean. Once we decided it was D-Wave, it was pretty easy to say that if you stick an STM tip in, you're going to tunnel in all directions, you're going to smear out, and you're going to get these nice V-shaped spectroscopy curves characteristic of D-Wave superconductors. But from the whole idea of the Josephson experiments we do is you can use planar interfaces to get very directional tunneling, at least somewhat directional tunneling, enough to determine the phase anisotropy of these systems. And so if we make junctions on very flat interfaces along the 1-1-1-0-0 direction, my question is, why don't we actually see fully formed gaps? From my point of view, there is no way that this system should even know that this is D-Wave when you're tunneling planarly or directionally into this system. That's something that's really bothered me. I know that, you know, you always get a little broadening due to roughness of the interface. You get, there's a direction of a cone here. There's lots of reasons, but not enough that I can see for explaining why you never, ever see a curve like that. So I'll just raise that as an issue. So thank you.
That go on different directions. Now, I actually don't think, I mean, I think it probably can be a very different mechanism than stripes, but you might want to consider that also for the local probes. You will be measuring those things, and will that have to do with stripes? That's one thing that I wanted to bring up. And the other thing is that I'm actually pretty happy with this. Why you never get any clean gaps. And in our BISCO single crystal tunneling, we like to do this with YPC also. We actually can see directionality, you know, when we're in a copper oxygen bond direction or 45 degrees in copper oxygen we do see what you expect, and the gap's cleaning up a little bit, but we still can't make the surface. We have, you and I talked about techniques, we might be able to make smoother and smoother surfaces. But I think it's just an intrinsic property of any unconventional superconductor that you're just going to cause all kinds of quasi particle formation with a non-perfect surface.
I agree that's a problem. I don't buy it because we're doing these Josephson junction experiments where we can show pretty clearly the directionality is pretty good, at least in the Josephson channel. And I don't really understand why it wouldn't be as good in the quasi-particle channel.
Dale, would you like to comment on what you might call a role of intermittency in this subject, since you two are bigger, and this is a good time. All right, I'll take a photo, all right? Yes, all right. What about the possibility that many, many important phenomena come and go? Not because you're an experimentalist, because whether they're there or not, depends on some ordering phenomena that are affected by how you make the samples. Is that good science, or is that science fiction?
Well, I think it's true. You see those kind of things. You always see those in high TC. I think that's one of the reasons we went to these phase-sensitive measurements. They seem to be, there isn't intermittency in the phase-sensitive measurements. They are much more reproducible because they average over some of those effects. And you look at the quasi-particle tunnel, yes, it does depend a lot on how you prepare your interfaces.
You slipped right over the essence of the question. Let me ask it again.
Do I think it's a real effect of intermittency?
No. Isn't it true in this subject, I'm asking a question, that often when you strive for reproducibility, what you wind up with is the least common denominator? In other words, you systematically eliminate all the effects by means of preparing samples. Okay? In other words, isn't it not possible that these crazy things that happen in the experiments are not mistakes, they're effects?
Absolutely, and that's the whole point. I think the word local probes appears here many times in my write-up, because I think that what we're learning, if you look at Seamus Davis's work, if you look at anything we've all known, is that the smaller you get, the more chance you have of finding effects that are local or unique to the system.
And I think by using the different probes, you might be measuring different things, and by using local probes, you may not see a certain effect that you would see in other ways. So you have to look at everything together.
Right. Well, this strikes me as a profound cultural difference between the way we do superconductivity research now and the way I was taught it. Before, well, Paul Chu, you like to make jokes about unidentified superconducting objects, USOs.
Right.
And I've been very concerned for a long time that those were real and that this wasn't green men from outer space, but we were throwing the baby out of the bath.
There's still stuff at 240 Kelvin you can see all the time that we don't understand. Right?
But focus on this question here about the definitive test for spin charge separation. And maybe John, could you say something about, can we expect that these experiments will be done now in the near future? And have a reasonable experiment?
I think they are reasonable. I know of three groups who are sort of actively planning to try to do it. You know, if you pull it apart, you know, what you need is an undernode superconductor. You need to drill a hole, you need to image a vortex, you need to heat it up, and then you need to cool it down and image it again. And the times are not too fast. It's damn easy to image vortices. It just does not seem, I can't wait to call it the old tar-baiting experiment, because, you know, maybe once you get involved with it, things might look more complicated. That's my business. No, I think it's I have to ask a question.
Okay, sorry.
And the question is,
if we, I'm sorry for using that. If the scientific experimentalists come up with a definitive yes-no answer, what will that say? How general will that, how general a question will that answer? I mean,
depends whether it's yes or no. I think it's yes, we're in a good shape.
No, it's no for a
good shape, too. Yeah, I'll comment on the experiment. I don't know if I'm on your list of three. If not, there's four. So I think it's a great experiment. Let me just say more globally, that's the kind of thing we want out of the theorists. We need these kind of definitive, testable things. And we're willing, I think an experimentalist wanted to look for things where they think they, you know, experiments are hard to do, so we want to have some belief that there's going to be some kind of an answer that comes out of it. So Patrick proposed some nice things in the Vortex Core. Those are the kind of things that really drive us. So yes, we love that proposal. We need lots more because there's a lot of experimentalists. We can't all do the same one.
So unlike Dale, I forgot completely that I had promised to give a talk on the last day of the conference. So while watching Al Gore last night, I realized with a shock that I had to write down something. Which was actually a nice break from Al Gore. So the benefit of doing it late is that I could sketch out cartoons of the beautiful data that were reported by various speakers. So what I'm going to pull together are both a rehash, and I apologize for that, as well as an attempt to point out the issues that I would like to see some progress on. And unfortunately, it doesn't look that good. And attempts to sort of make these vague connections between very different experimental techniques, trying to correlate phenomena, and okay, let's see how it goes. So I kept writing because Gore kept talking. And I'll stop when Bob starts yelling at me. Okay, Bob? All right, so transport, quasi-particles, I think interests in their properties, lifetime and so on, there were a significant number of talks. So let me try to remind you what the difficulties are. Actually, this is a very nice stage in the evolution of experimental techniques, because ArcGIS is now approaching very high resolution, and finally addressing issues that are of great interest to people who do transport. All right, so Peter Johnson's data, which he talked about, showed that at the nodes, the lifetime is more or less retains its key linear temperature dependence. And he discussed the difference between EDC and DC. And there are many technical issues that are hidden. I couldn't say everything in a 15-minute talk. But in conversations with JC, ZX, and Adam Kaminsky, I realized that this... The data really look very similar, and it really depends on how one unfolds it. So, to remind you, Fukuzano briefly alluded to this, and it appears, now correct me if I'm wrong, it appears that what the Brookhaven group has been doing is actually using the EDC width at very high energies, which means somewhere here. Let me remind you that imaginary sigma versus omega that's approaching the Fermi level, according to the Campuzano's group, shows a little dip when you go above the kink. And what the Brookhaven group has been doing is using essentially this value, using the Fermi velocity very close to the Fermi level, and then deriving the mean free path. Anyway, this is the result. And I think there's a disagreement, although it didn't come up very clearly, even between RFS groups, after you do the analysis that, say, Campuzano has done, about whether this is, in fact, the case. I think JC would say that this really comes down if you take this seriously. Unfortunately, it rapidly drops below the current resolution. And all right, so again, to put numbers in, if you take Peter's data literally, this is a mean free path of 24 angstroms, right at TC. And already at transport, we're measuring 100 angstroms there, and it rapidly inflates to 400 angstroms in BISCO and a micron in YBCO. So that's sort of the numbers game. Now in transport, there's also disagreement between various techniques, different groups. Our measurements on both kappa XX and kappa XY show this very dramatic enhancement of 1,000 in kappa XY, which corresponds to a mean free path increase of about 100 in rather good agreement actually with Doug Bond's microwave measurements. But the disagreement, or rather the lack of self-consistency at the moment, is how abrupt is this increase? The microwave measurements, you cannot extract Tor because of dispersion. I'll say more in the next slide. Anyway, Tor is not available near TC. However, there's this very interesting fact, which Ornstein pointed out, that the conductivity itself, in other words, the number of quasi-particles times the lifetime, is continuous through TC. Ornstein also presented this data where the effective scattering rate based on, directly measured quantities, that real part, the imaginary part of sigma versus the real part, divided by the real part. And that also shows a continuous behavior in agreement with RFS. So there are disagreements all around, right? So with different groups of techniques choosing different sides of this question. And I think this issue should be resolved in a few years. All right, so that's an experimental question. So the other issue regarding the long lifetime is the following. Well, here I remind you of the data reported by Doug Bond. In these new generation of crystals, you see very strong dispersion at fairly low frequencies, below 100 gigahertz. And that already implies, just eyeballing it, very long lifetimes. And the lifetimes they're talking about are 10 to 20 picoseconds, corresponding to mean free paths of about a micron or 1 to 5 microns. And the issue then is this really inconsistent with the existence of fluctuating stripes? Can there be charge in homogeneities in the superconducting state? This I thought would be a hot topic of discussion, and I think ZX tried to jumpstart it by showing the NQR results. But unfortunately, the discussion went in a different direction. So this remains with us. There is this fact that Basov reminded us of, that this is very familiar from the RFS data, now observed directly by FIR, far infrared reflectivity. And is this steep drop? Sorry?
The other way around. It's familiar.
Oh, I'm sorry, historically. I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you. Right. So this was first pointed out by Timmer's group. And is this an indication of a coherent mode that you suddenly see? And therefore, if you're using probes like we are, microwave or DC transport, you will never see this collective mode. Now, when I pose this to theorists that will listen to me, they say, well, if it's way up there, then it's irrelevant. Now, is that the case? And do all the theorists agree with that? If you don't see it, how will the quasi-particles or electrons, why would they care about something that's at such a high energy? All right, so that's topic number two. A very interesting subject experiment was discussed by Kai Fair and Richard Green, and that is this question about, are there fermionic excitations in PCCO, the electron doped material, in normal state. So let me remind you what the data was. They plot kappa over T versus T squared, and if there's a T linear term in kappa, that would appear here, because this is the value anticipated from the Wiedemann-Franz ratio. So on the face of it, this looks like it's saying that there are no fermionic excitations in PCCO. Now, people who have been in this field for a number of years will recall that 4 or 5 years ago, there was this flurry of interest in HC2 versus T. The HC2 measured in bismuth 2201 and thallium 2201 appear to be diverging with a upwards curvature. And the HC2 was determined by purely resistive transition. And if you look at the data, it seems very convincing, because it's zero, has a step function upwards, and it's flat thereafter. But this has since become quite controversial, because other experiments appear to show that the true HC2, the thermodynamic field, is about 3 times higher. So this raises all kinds of questions. Is 13 Tesla sufficient to completely kill superconductivity, or is one simply observing the vortex liquid state? Having said that, what are the transport properties of this vortex liquid state? I don't think that's very well understood. Why don't you see the ordinary quasi-particles, the D-wave quasi-particles, even if that were true, right? This is a very interesting experiment, I'm sure. There'll be lots of probes, torque magnetometry, Nernst effect, heat capacity that will be directed towards this question. Now, actually, there is a similar paradox in the 248 compound, in the yttrium YBCO heat chain compound. There you cannot kill superconductivity in fields of 10 to 20 Tesla, but in zero field, you don't see fermionic excitations. There are no D-wave quasi-particles. These are the results by Cameron Bernier, and I think it's in press. So in these two materials, and even in zero field, there is this problem. There are no D-wave quasi-particles in the limit of zero temperature. How much time do I have left?
Just a couple more minutes.
Yeah. Okay, let me just... maybe I should stop there. Yeah, let's just take more.
Fine, I mean, I completely agree with the bulk of the comments that you made about thallium 2201. The only thing I just wanted to mention, because I think it's actually quite important, you said the true thermodynamic HC2 is a factor of 3 higher. I think, one, at low temperatures, there's very little evidence for that particular statement. I mean, I don't dispute the fact that there's probably some kind of a strange vortex liquid above the resistive line. But second, What is the meaning of the true thermodynamic HC2? I mean, in a conventional superconductor, HC2 is a second order phase transition to do with the correlation length of the vortex lattice. So, you know, the only phase transition you expect in the HD plane is the one that happens at the resistive transition, and then you're just into kind of some broad crossover region, which I've always thought is remarkably poorly understood. And in some senses, Louis and I have plans now to go back and relook at thallium 2201 and try to understand it a little better. But just this general point that people often use that term, the true thermodynamic HC2, and I'm certainly not clear what that means.
Yeah, actually, I agree with that remark. I think the region when you are at very low temperatures, the region above some sharp field-induced transition is probably this soup of vortices and quasi-particles that's very poorly understood.
Very, very poorly, yeah.
Any more questions?
So how much is known about the doping dependence of, say, the upper critical field, unquote? Because, you know, there's a lot of theories like Patrick is kind of really...
There are very few experiments that can attain HC2. There are very few cuprates, right, for which that can be done. And so these three are the only ones, practically. Now, the experiments of Bobinger and Ando you're slamming 60 Tesla into the material, and then of course then you don't know where HT2 is, although I guess they do have estimates based on the, these high field experiments. But there, sometimes it's very hard to pin down as well. So correct me if I'm wrong, in LSCO, that seems to work fine.
Yeah.
But when you do the experiment in underdoped YBCO, which is where you want to do it, then you get very confusing results. In fact, you don't even see this onset of the log T term in YBCO, except for very underdoped materials. So resistive transitions are a very poor way indeed to pin down HC2.
Yeah, I think actually the issue of on the monoplasma particles was addressed. That Sibir is still here, so I mean the inverse of his talk directly addressed that. Actually, that given the monoplasma particles, they essentially completely decouple from stratified fluctuations, basically for the simple reason that the wave vector mismatch relative to the space in between nodes. So it's not really an issue.
So would you care to comment on this off-the-cuff remark that if it's decoupled from the quasi-particles,
yeah, so
why would they care about the these excitations?
So if I start, getting a little on what your starting point is, if I start with a picture of nodal quasi-particles and then turn on a coupling to strongly fluctuating structure, it doesn't nest the nodal points. And so its effect in scattering is very weak.
But why does it reject the nodal points at 45 degrees in the first place?
Well, it depends on how strong the strike potential is. That's again, also, you can do simple calculations with sort of strike potential, you still get nodal quasi particles. They're quite hard to destroy. You have to have very, very enormously strong strike potential to destroy them.
That's a chart. What about the spin part? Right? Supposedly they're anti-permanent and remains between the strikes.
But they still don't nest the nodal plasma particles. I mean, look, the question is where the nodal plasma particles are. That's a deep question. You need to understand it microscopically. But what you can answer crisply, and what I think Supir did answer crisply, is that if you have nodal plasma particles, their lifetime is seriously decoupled from the strike distance.
Okay, well, I have one more.
Made a contrast between the lack of any feature in the microwave conductivity in the WBC and a very clear sharp line in the real conductivity. Now, why isn't this just very simply anisotropic in the lab experiment? I mean, that's what you expect the origin to be of the very clear.
You mean forward scattering versus 2KF scattering? In conventional metals, that can at most give you a factor of 2 or 50% difference. You know, it's not, you can't appeal to 2KF scattering.
The effect is larger than the higher.
Yeah, but we're talking about TC, right? At TC, 100 Kelvin. Where you're going from 100 angstrom mean free path, and then by the time you get to like 5 or 10 Kelvin below TC, it is inflated to 1,000 angstroms and it keeps rising.
On the Supir part of it, in ordinary superconductors, there's a coherence peak in sigma 1 at these frequencies so much lower than TC, which would tend to keep sigma 1 high. There wouldn't be a coherence peak in the ultrasonic attenuation on thermal conductivity. So there's a natural reason residing there for why 1 would go down or up, whatever, more rapidly below TC. Although a strong coherence peak features aren't seen in NMR or in sigma 1. That, there is a reason why they could be quite different near TC than a simple one.
Yeah.
Just a short comment. I mean, yeah, for the electrical transport, you know, when you get these long mean free paths, they should be much longer than they are for thermal transport, because you have to have something like Ohm clock or internode scattering to hurt the current. And you just don't need that. So even though you can block me pretty fast, I think the way it works is that what they're saying in the microwave is actually just much longer.
No, no, the paradox is not at very low temperatures.
Well, I'm just talking about when you go up to your peaks. I mean, you...
Right at TC, I'm talking about the sharp breaking slope right
here. Yeah, but when you get up to a micron,
right,
then those mainframe paths should be different.
Yeah, that's not the paradox. Yeah, I'm not worried about that. Yeah. I'm not talking about the difference between the 1 micron that we see and the 20 picoseconds that Doug sees. I mean, you know, within a factor of 2, you know, there are... We're not worried about that factor of 2. We're talking about a sharp break at TC.
Well, I think, the ZX tends to be short.
Yeah, okay. Now, I'm just mentioning that issue of the noble particle strike. Even in static charge orders, like near imaging systems, under favorable conditions, you can still see a little bit of spectral wave at the noble direction and all of that. Obviously, at this point, we can't rule out that there's a small minority phase in the centrals in the could cause that. But if we've done enough systematics, we felt that really we're intrinsic to the problem. Another thing which is very interesting, that if you compare the strike phase in the electronic state of the charge orbit, static charge orbit thing, in that of a one-dimensional chain, of that's Perfidinian 123, or YBCO 123. And the behavior is actually quite different from the dispersion of those really well separated real chains, much larger. You can consider that you really have the spin charge circuit in a very well refined form, a lot of on the other hand, the electronic state of the strike phase then is actually more looking like a two dimensional field. It's like quite a 2D. So, in that sense, it will be somewhat different.
Okay, I thought I'd try to address question one and then maybe question four of Morris's. So what I've laid down here is the phase diagram, which we can't see. And there's a particular phase diagram we talked about, and the red region, the pseudo-gap region, seems to be one that has evoked a wide range of theories for. And I've listed some of these theories, and the real question that I'd like to raise, and that I think we need to raise, is when would you abandon your theory? And I was bothered very much when David Pines was asked when he would abandon a spin fluctuation theory, and he said, well, he might abandon it over in this region, but not over in this region. Well, I think that shows you how extremely difficult it's going to be to get any of us to abandon what we like. There's always going to be some narrow region that we can hang on to, no matter what you find. And I think that's distressing, because I think the right answer is if fractionalization and if the central Fisher experiment is on and is found that it turns out that way and there's fractionalization, then I'll just speak for myself, but I'll certainly abandon any ideas I had about this. And I think likewise, it would be nice if we could look at the different theoretical proposals that had been put forward and try and decide where we might abandon them. I remind you of one that's not so long ago, which was the interplane tunneling, a very interesting idea, which I believe in a way Kirtley and Cam Moeller and plasma frequency, who? Vandermeer laid to rest. by making a measurement that simply showed there wasn't enough binding energy between the layers that you could viably go after a theory that was based on that. Somehow or another, it seems to me that not only out of this conference, but out of our workshop, if various proposals, such as the Fischel central proposal for an experiment, could be laid out so that we somehow could move on and leave some baggage behind us and move on to other things, that would be very helpful. I think the difficulty in doing this is that there are some proposals that I think lend themselves much more for this than others, particularly a proposal that specifies a rather specific phase that you're going to come out of, the mother phase of the superconductor, that you can make some measurement on, particularly if it's a topological phase, then it's yes, no. If it is an orbital angular momentum, orbital antiferromagnetism phase that has a very definite signature of some type, it again seems to me, I don't know if Patrick would and Laughlin and Sudip would agree, but it seemed to me this has a chance of hopefully being measured. You see it or you don't see it, and maybe you move on. Morris told us about another picture of the pseudo gap that I like a great deal. It seems to me that some of the numerical data that one has on 2-3-4 leg ladders, at least the 3-leg ladders, support a notion that as you dope these systems, there is Umklapp blockage of some type that knocks out regions of the Fermi surface. Well, now the problem with this in some ways is it seems to me we have those experiments. They're very nice experiments of the angular resolved photo emission that showed as the doping proceeded across this region that one went from nodal regions in some materials and opened out, just as one might have hoped based on these ideas. Let me come over here for a minute. Here the problem, I think, is that things didn't happen fast enough. If you go back to 86 and 87, when there were predictions that this thing might be a D wave and it might be driven by spin fluctuation, there were no measurements telling it was D wave. And so that somehow the prediction of those ideas, which was this was an exotic superconductor, this was D wave, those measurements weren't made. And we lingered long enough to develop a whole host of theories that all have D wave, and it doesn't distinguish. And so my notion is, and what I would say I would like to see come both out of the workshop and more into what we need, are ideas for experiments that could distinguish. Let me not leave the SO5 out here. I think I have this picture right. Zhang's picture of the SO5 would say that this pseudo gap region comes about as a region associated with the fact that you have neither antiferromagnetism nor do you have superconducting order, but that you have a fluctuation involving all five components of this object. There is a model that we know very well that we've run many simulations on, that graduate students here, in fact, have got theses on, which is the negative U-Hubbard model. Negative U-Hubbard model in two dimensions, when you cool it down, when you go to zero temperature, has both at half-filling long-range CDW and superconducting pairing correlations. As you warm it up, not as you warm it up, as you dope it, you favor the superconductivity. It has a Kosterlitz thallus superconducting transition in 2D here. And there's a wide region in here where the behavior of this system is one that is fluctuating between the two competing order parameters, the CDW and the superconductor, and it's a three-component object that's fluctuating, which reminds one, or at least reminds me, of what Shojen has suggested here. And I know there are experiments there, but again, I think tough ones, experiments where he would like to believe that, or not believe, he would like to find that if instead of varying doping, you could vary pressure, and you could come out from an antiferromagnetic region, hit a critical point, and go superconducting, that at that critical point, you would see indices associated with SO5. And furthermore, as you then doped out trying to get into the real system, say YBCO7, you would see a crossover function, and that crossover function would be one you would predict from SO5, and the reach would be so long that you could reach all the way over to Walter Hardy's experiment where he found the index to be 2/3, which is like the 3DXY model. Again, if those experiments could be done, it would test the theory, but that brings, I think, the last point of this slide. If the theorists, unless the theorists are very fortunate and very clever and can talk with the experimentalists, it's very difficult to design doable experiments that really test. And I think that's what's special about Sentell's experiment. But finally, I leave it with this final remark. What experiments can distinguish it? But more important, when will we get agreement? Maybe we need signed agreements as to when you will abandon your theory. So let me go on for one more. I want to go on to number 4 there. Minimal models. What is a minimal model that does this? Well, I've started making too long a list here, but up at the top, of course, we have Hubbard one-band TJ models. Those certainly early on were models thought to encompass some of the chemistry of the copper-oxygen layers. They've been tested, as you well know. You can turn on next-near-neighbor hopping, you can turn on next-near-neighbor Coulomb interactions, you can go on and on with these models. What is a minimal or what is the right model? But I think perhaps more importantly, you can go and take into account that we really are dealing with charge transfer insulators. So we really have copper, oxygen, copper. And I think that's presumably very important in nature. And if you try and look at an effective exchange between these two copper spins, we know that you get effective hopping here, which can then carry you over there, which is this parameter. And you get a 1 over U for the Coulomb. But even if the Coulomb interaction were very, very large on the copper, forcing you over towards what would be this Hubbard model in very large U, you still have the possibility, this is an oxygen U, you still have the possibility of the exchange coming when the two objects pass each other on the oxygen. And so it's very natural to imagine that you could relax either of these models to, once again, integrating out the oxygen. The reason you do this is if you're doing numerical work, you've got to reduce the size of the system. If you're doing some simple theory, you probably would like to integrate out these degrees of freedom. But maybe you better relax your model and let it be a TUJ model, meaning TJ would have U infinite. Let's relax U so things could get on the same site a little bit. What we find in our calculations is this makes a great deal of difference as to how mobile the pairs are and how susceptible to superconductivity it is. Now we come down, though, to more interesting interactions, part 3 somehow here. I've written just one down. But I would come back to here, charge spin separation, topological order, does it exist? Well, it's going to be very nice to have these experiments that will tell us whether the system has it. That's the most important thing. But at least for me, I would like very much to have a microscopic model that one could write down in terms of spins and in terms of the ordinary Fermi operators, C adjoint and C, and maybe some other things you would want. But I call it in terms of what? Old-fashioned particle and spin operators that would then go over and have these properties that would be a local model with no long string interactions, no others. I think it would be very interesting to find such a model and study it. It may be that adding terms that provide a four-ring exchange or adding further interactions. And then the question can come, are those interactions big enough from the quantum chemistry we know? Finally, I put at the very bottom something that, again, I think we get, I know I do, very prejudiced about. We have not had any talk here about electron-phonon interaction that I remember. We haven't. Werner Hanke said a bit about long-range Coulomb interaction, certainly. What Steve has said, and I'm sorry I didn't stress the strikes, but you saw it earlier, the pneumatics is one example. But long-range coulomb plays a role there. But we also know that phonons, if you had a buckled, as you do in some of the superconductors, copper oxide sheet, if you let that oxygen move up and down, as I've indicated here, it'll drive a D wave. I don't happen to believe that that's important in this system, but maybe there are things that we don't even talk about all week that when we finally look back at this, we'll be sorry we didn't mention. And I wish I knew what those were, and a little like Dale Van Harling, and I suppose if I knew what they were, I certainly wouldn't stand up here and talk about it. Anyway, those were things that I thought to address perhaps questions 1 and 4.
You raised the issue of the minimal law, which I think is a very important issue. The problem is, I'm not entirely sure if the minimal law will come out to be some simple item from the current law, which is essentially the part that has been pursued since 1986. The other option is that, you know, you identify what are effective abuse of freedom, the negative space transition possible, which the neutral main state possible. And having an understanding which is as good as you can say for the magnetic state, and that doesn't necessarily have a play on the theory of fire. So I see models are perfectly good. And so the question is perhaps what we need to do is to identify the use of freedom that participate in the phenomenon. And perhaps it is the microscopic models really deceiving us in the physics. I think that that's the path I have been pursuing with this. Sky picture that perhaps is the same by microscopic structures that form the cells are maybe one part of the way that you use the videos in other areas. Now, maybe that's the wrong part, and I would use those to consider.
What Eduardo is saying, particularly in here in the back, I do agree with you. What I lay down the models, I lay down rather microscopic Hubbard-like models, or at least it started from something you might think of as a piece of a quantum chemical calculation. And what he's suggesting is a lot of the times the way we make progress on many body problems is to put down a Hamiltonian that embodies the general degrees of freedom coupled in various ways that we feel is a more general, on symmetry grounds, way these things should be put together, which I would argue, although Matthew's here, he could say, is in the end a bit more like what I see as a piece of a Hamiltonian one might, or action one might write down for these theories. And they are beautiful actions, and one can study those and simulate those. And we are, or at least we're trying to simulate what their action is. But to me, I always feel a little ill at ease not knowing quite how to get from one to the other, but it may well be that you solve the more general structure and that leads you to where you want to go.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to make a comment that's sort of a follow-up on that, which is that in one of these models, it's taken not in terms of electrons, but in terms of degrees of freedom that are not too unphysical, namely a talking dimer model, which the dimer you might think represents a real space group of pair. There's been, I think, an important, at least to me, important piece of progress in this, which is a paper that appeared on the web last week by Mosner and Sandi, in which they showed that in this model on a triangular lattice, spinons and bolons are exist in our deconfined. I think that's an important step.
And we'll reserve judgment as to the truth of this. This is an extremely amazing thing and true, and therefore there's reason to believe it isn't.
I'd like to address the question of the base diagram, and that you're drawing it now as if, I hope that it's not everyone has used it
no.
like that.
Look,
in principle, at least, there's plenty of evidence that the pseudo-patch phase extends well into the older growth phases. So that is one thing you get, that there's certain conditions in certain materials.
Tom, you're dealing with a man who sat there and drew these view graphs within the last 5 or 10 minutes that Morris gave me a pen. So I apologize. We'll have that wherever you would like. But that's a good point.
I think the as
as to the models, I think really depend on what kind of question you are addressing. I think if you are addressing meeting high energy question, like what's the carrying scale, what's the cost of carrying, I think a Microsoft model like that is inevitable. But if you are shooting at addressing a very low energy question, like transport, and I think in that case, you have to
Yeah, no. I'm
worried about the company worried about some other thing that we've always neglected, and that is the impurity potential. And that's a bit related to whether you have a Hubbard-like model or whether you have to use the charge transfer gap model. Because we've seen today, and as we already knew some time ago, that there's a very big difference, apparently, between the hole doped and the electron doped materials. So in any case, we cannot describe them within the same kind of model with the same kind of parameters, at least. So in any case, the parameters would be widely different for a hole doped and for an electron doped system. But the thing that really bothers me is that it seems that the electron doped systems are the charge carriers, whatever they are localized. And that this is in agreement with, kind of, shall we say, the large extent of the antiferromagnetic region, which then, as Bob Bergno mentioned, is more like a percolating type of transition and things like this. So it looks like they are localized, and they can only be localized, I would think, within any of our models by an impurity potential, which is due to the cerium or whatever is the case. So I'm getting very concerned about the impurity potential, at least for the case of the electron doped, and if they're important there, exactly. But that is disorder outside of the plane. So I'm concerned now also about disorder outside of the plane rather than only disorder in the plane itself. So,
I would worry more if it's intrinsic disorder, because somehow or another, if it's just real disorder that causes this, I would like to believe that some of the material that's being made is actually beating that problem, like the ortho 2 material where the chains are aligned and so forth. And that if it's intrinsic, though, disorder of some type, then I agree completely with you. That gets over nearer to me to the stripes.
Therefore, I think it's very important to look at to compare really with the same concentration the ortho phases and the disorder phases.
I want to emphasize maybe the importance of really trying to nail down experimentally or get good samples in a very, very overdoped regime. I mean, as theorists, it feels like we're sort of grasping for things that we actually understand well. If you look at some of the history, we recognize magnetism, a simple antiferromagnet, as something we really can understand, at least the low energy properties, and so we're using that as a springboard to try to move to the right, to try to understand what's going on. Some of us have also been trying to use the D-wave superconductor, which we think we understand, as a springboard. But the phase that we think we understand best theoretically is the Fermi liquid, and well, many of us feel that has to be somewhere on this phase diagram to the right of the D-wave superconductor. I realize the samples are very hard to make over there, but I think it's a challenge to the crystal growers to try to get us over there to see how the sort of exotic physics we don't really understand matches on to something which we do understand better, in the, a normal state which we do understand, which presumably is sitting over there larger than.
Yeah, just on the experiments, I'd just like to mention what this group of Ben is true in Maryland. It's been doing some really nice work on photodoping of insulating materials and actually painting devices on them, which we didn't hear about at this conference. But it seems like, tests, for instance, of SO5 theory and probably even of some other theories could be made with these photodoping techniques. They haven't been done yet, I think. But they have observed this long-range proximity effect in the insulating background. And I just wonder if the experimentalists think that this technique actually makes sense in the sense that it makes well-defined, controllable samples with insulating and doping regions that you can control, whether that might not be a fruitful way of testing various theories.
but thank you very much. Before I call Patrick, Douglas asked me to remind the speakers to bring their viewgraphs to be scanned, and if they leave before they get them back, they will be sent on by snail mail, I guess, or you can, they can be scanned on the way again. But please hand in your viewgraphs.
Okay, I'd like to start by addressing question number 7. Which is one of the factors that determine TC. I mean, this is of course a big problem for those of us who want to start with microscopic model, because there should be one universal TC curve. And I want to argue for that there are actually two classes of oxides. The first class is YBCO, BISCO, and so on, going up to mercury. And here I want to ask a question to experimentalists: is there? Well, first, well, okay, so these all have TC within 30% of each other, let's say, or the same structure. So within this group, you can ask, why is mercury better? Is there evidence that the exchange is increasing? Because for us microscopic people, the only number is exchange. So that is an experimentally answerable question. I simply don't know whether people even thought about it or other experiments. You can do Raman scattering or whatnot. That would be something valuable.
I mean, there's a cause and effect issue here. Even if they correlate, TC goes up with J.
Yeah.
Is it the J that's causing the TC, or the fact?
No. I'm just wanting to establish. Yeah. Just getting experimental facts would
sure.
be. I'm just appealing to our friends here. The second one, because this separation is more controversial, but Nature definitely produces with two classes. This typically have lower TC, about 40 Kelvin. LISCO is a canonic example. I think one layer of LISCO seems to be like that. And I guess a good candidate for us who wants to rig a lot of things is that these are strike materials with strikes. And I think all the data that we've seen so far seem to point to that at least in LSCO, there's strong evidence for stripes, and either static or dynamical, they're doing their trick. And despite people's effort to look for stripes in YBCO, I think it's fair to say that has not been overwhelmingly successful. Now, but in fact, I can make a stronger statement for that, because I think there's experimental evidence that you can turn group 2 into group 1 if you work at it. Okay? There's this marvelous experiment by Loquet et al., published 2 years ago in Nature, where he takes the lanthanum strontium. And he made MB grown film on a substrate, which allows him either to stretch it or compress it. When he stretches it, this is a 10% sample, and about this is your canonical resistivity curve. When you stretch it, it becomes your canonical bad behaved insulator. When you compress it, I would maintain that this resistivity curve looks indistinguishable from your best underdope YBCO sample. It has actually has a negative intercept. The resistivity is so wonderful that when you extrapolate it goes negative. He sees a spin gap. What we understand is the onset of spin gap T star, which you never see in the 214. And TC went up to 49 Kelvin from 20 Kelvin. Okay. And 49 Kelvin is basically what you expect for an underdope YBCO, 10% doping. Okay? So it is indeed possible to convert from a group 2 to group 1. Okay? So something is happening when you squeeze it. We don't know exactly what's happening. Maybe the tilting of the hydro is important or whatnot. If I'm allowed to speculate, of course I would like to speculate that by compressing it, you get rid of your stripe.
Sounds like point three.
Hmm? You're addressing
point three, then.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's my. Okay. Now back to theory and you know what, where we're going and where we are and so on. I'm very optimistic about where we are. I think I'd be very good. I think we're heading.
This is California.
You know what? Yeah. I'm not going to leave. I'm going to stay here. Weather is nice. Tennis game this afternoon. Okay. Yeah, I think we're making progress. I think compared with 10 years ago. But I think, where do I think we stand? Well, I would want to insist that dogma number one is that dope modern insulator is the problem, and we better focus our attention to that and not be sidetracked into any other thing. So this, I will not give up on this point. And even if it turns out to have nothing to do with high density spoons, it's still an interesting problem. So let's work on this problem. Okay, so once you accepted that, then you ask yourself, what can you do with this problem? Okay, so the traditional tools available to a theoretical physicist, there are basically three. One is that you try to do an analytic theory at your own risk, at great risk. Second is that you do numerics, and third is you do phenomenology, right? And all the time, for us condensed matter people, the goal is to talk to experimentalists and have checks, and you change your route along the way. So that's worked for 40 years, and I don't see why it should not keep working for us on this problem, despite what Bob wants to say. Okay, so I'm leading you down a garden path, as you can see. If you want to do analytic theory on a dope mod insulator problem, then the only game in town is gauge theory, I'm afraid. There's no other tool that we know. I hope someone will invent one, but there is no other tool. Now, what do? We struggle and approximate and try the best we can. But I think what we have to do is to make concrete predictions. And this is one wonderful example that Senthil and Fisher made for us. They stuck their neck out, right? They made this very concrete prediction that can be done within the next few months, and I'm sure it will be done. And we'll know the answer, right? And then we can count the bodies. So I was very inspired by that. I think this is exactly what we need to do.
I've already lost my house.
You don't know what's coming yet. Yeah. So I certainly was very much inspired by that. So I stuck my neck out, right? With the current loops, they're concrete experiments. They're doable. They're hard, but they're doable. And within the next month or a year, we'll know the answer, and there will be more bodies that you can cut. All right. And I think this is really what we should do. I think the time is over. The theorist can stand up and wave his hands about fluctuating this, fluctuating that, and without anything that anyone can test. I think those people really should lose their house. Okay. So enough of. All right, so this is one important lesson that I learned here. The second thing I learned here is numerics. And I think I've seen remarkable progress. The talk by Steve White is wonderful. And in fact, there are work by Sorella, very comparable. They, as Steve says, they compare notes. And within small error, they're seeing the same thing. And what did Steve see? What he teaches us is that the TJ model has strong competing phases very close by in energy. If you tune the parameter, you can go from one to the other within the accuracy of his calculation. And the ones that we focus on are these superconductors that he discovered, stripes that he finds. And the third phase that he talked about that he didn't spend much time on is actually the most interesting one that I got excited about, because he actually found a metallic phase. Right. Remember, when he changed tuning his parameter, the holes unbind. To me, that's the most interesting part of his talk, because we don't know of any example of a metal ground state. Then you can ask, is it a Fermi liquid? Does it break translational symmetry? Is this the orbital current phase that I love so much? And so on. Okay, but this lesson, I think, it really supports this point of view that I try to push before now, that we have two kinds of superconductors, right? Because if indeed they are competing phases, then it's very natural that if you sneeze on it, this guy turns into that, and so on and so forth. So I think there is some common grounds that is being shown. And these calculations, I think, are unimaginable 10 years ago. So I think we have made progress.
But one important message that we learned from Steve is something that seems to go by without people paying too much attention, that indeed TJ model with some modification, I think he has strong evidence, and also with the work of Sorella, that has a superconducting ground state. So I think we are close to establishing, that out of a purely repulsive model you can get superconductivity. I think that's an important statement. Okay. And here I disagree very strongly with the comment that Werner Hanke made, that that you know we should be worrying about embellishing TJ model with this or that term. I think it is not a job of the fundamental physics to find up to come up with the best Hamiltonian to describe the coupe race, but it is rather that we should look for these different fixed points and how to understand them, and so I think I'm quite happy to play with this in this restricted phase space. The future, I believe we should focus on the underdog side. Traditionally, the spin fluctuation phenomenology have worked, people have focused on this side. I think that line of investigation has run its course. I think they have convinced us that there are indeed, if you tune your coupling constant to spin fluctuation, you can indeed get a D-wave superconductor. But that's not the problem. The problem is here. Right? This is what we should be focusing on. As far as this problem is concerned, I think Chakravarti and company asked exactly the right question. Is there a hidden order here that remains to be discovered? Because I think the only competing interpretation of this underdog region is that it's fluctuating superconductivity. But I think that more and more does not look like fluctuating superconductivity. And if you want to make it fluctuating superconductivity, that makes your problem even bigger because you have to ask where the superconductivity with a huge gap is coming from in the first place. So there must be some kind of a hidden order behind it. And here, let me just point out that there are two points of departure from what we've been saying with Wen since 4 years ago. The first is that, as I quote them, that they came up with this orbital antiparamagnetic, that they favor this unphenomenological ground, whereas our starting point is microscopic theory. And it is very important to us that this owes its existence to being in proximity to the mod insulator. And as usual, Phil Anderson asked the most perceptive question to Chetan Nayak, and I applaud Chetan for answering this question in a straightforward way, yes or no answer. Right? He could have wriggled out of it, but he gave a straightforward answer that indeed there is this phenomenology. Now, the second, of course, distinction is that it's a question of real phase transition versus crossover. And again, that is an important issue for us because in our picture, it has to be a crossover. It's part and parcel of the story. So for us, there's very little wriggling room, and that's why I stuck my neck out. As far as experiments is concerned, we heard Bertram says, your future is in plastics. All this high TC stuff will blow away in a few years anyway. And we'll be working on something else. So we better hurry and solve this problem before we the world.
However, you decided to focus on a few of your favorite phases. And one of the things we have learned about David is that the first thing, the first problem you have to confront when you don't have an insulator is that you get other kinds of order in the problem, which are not, as I think Bob wanted to say, mechanical in the sense that they are driven by electric instability. And these are what I like to call electronic liquid crystal phases, namely phases where you get some sort of charge order in these stripes, which I like to call it smectic or even the nomadic states and so on. And these are all part of this space diagram.
Yeah.
I don't see what they should be talking about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think what you say. No. Absolutely, and they are there. What you're saying is that when you first put in your first 2% hole, 1% hole, if there are no disorder, what happened to them? That's an open question. Very interesting question. They probably. Right. And I think it's very interesting question. There are experiments now showing up, you know, just rotating stripes. Absolutely interesting question that we want to address. Yeah.
Dr. Any comment about Eastern and the field? Your point about 2D and superconducting, and you showed this very nice data by Dokkan and so on. I'd like to remind ourselves about a very systematic study. It's not very well discussed, not very often discussed by a group in Cambridge, where they showed that 2.4 glass materials would have a 90 degree transition, give or take 5 degrees, if there would not be a disorder on the lanthanum side. And that can be done in a very straightforward experiment, wonderful experiment piece of work. Look at the variance of the radius on the A side. So the conclusion from that is if you make 2.4 in an ideal system, for instance by charge injection, you would have a DC of 90 degrees, and its suppression is a result indeed of the local disorder and whatever it implicates in terms of rotation and so on. So that one is, I just like to remind this additional piece of the research.
How did they come to this conclusion?
Sorry?
How can they possibly know this?
I try to remember what the detail is. For a given doping, you make 0.15, you'd like to introduce 0.15 points.
Yeah.
And there are different ways to do that. You put in lanthanum, strontium, barium, and a rather different variables for lanthanum with different ionic sizes. So you can make a very broad distribution of sizes on the A side. Keep resorting count the same. So the more disordered it is, they could show that the more TC is suppressed.
Well, I like your conclusion, but I don't like that method because it's easy to suppress TC, but this guy, you know, enhanced TC, and that's
the same. Yeah. It is the same. It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah, extrapolate the other way. Okay.
Extrapolating the other way.
Right.
Patrick, I just wanted to say that I have share a little bit of your optimism. A decade ago, when Ian and Ted and I tried to see whether there were any experimental ways of testing the staggered flux phase. The experimental situation was so murky. In USR experiments, we're seeing some magnetic fields, but there's this thin glass phase and so on. And so I agree. I think that there's some possibility of, you know, chewing it off or,
yeah,
you know, maybe a little bit.
Right.
I'd like to understand your comment about this staggered curve about the equal phase being quite different from the conventional thinking of the pseudo dynamic in a phase fluctuating
superconductor.
Superconductor. In a phase fluctuating superconductor, you have a lot of transverse current fluctuations, right? But when the system is to the proximity of the mass insulating limit, if you think of how does the transverse current fluctuate, they almost have to come in the standard loop. So is a strongly phase fluctuating superconductor phase really qualitatively different from this staggered?
Yeah, I would think so, because here, you know, even though you're underdoped, you're quite far away. You're quite far away from the half field situation. So there's no anti-ferromagnet. That's, you know, the correlation length here for the spin is like three lattice constant. Okay.
I'm not talking about anti-ferromagnet.
So what are you talking about?
Yeah, I'm talking about the
your proximity to
the phase fluctuating superconductor.
Yeah.
Close to the mass insulator.
You saying that automatically gives you staggered current?
Well, I mean now. Imagine you have fluctuating transverse current.
Yeah.
Then you have the mass constraint, which constraint that you know you cannot build up the architecture on the side.
Yeah.
How do you
well, maybe you're explaining. Maybe it's the same. You're saying the same thing. You're saying that what we find is trivial. That you can understand it very simply. That I can accept that.
I just want to come back about the discussion of Lokensa experiment and your comment. I don't think it goes necessarily in the opposite direction, because what happens As a matter of fact, as you compress, is that you elongate the z-axis, which means that you do decouple more.
No, we agree. We absolutely agree. Yeah there's no.
So in that sense,
oh yeah, we agree.
Okay,
we agree. No, I'm just saying that reducing TC is not as clear demonstration as raising TC. Yeah. They're on the same curve. They're just on the opposite side of the same curve.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Cleaning up what, Morris? Can we turn this off? Yeah, I want to turn it off. Yeah. By the way, that's the time.
How much? You started a bit late, so it's 15 minutes.
Okay, good. All right. Nice to have. Oh, don't sigh, David. Come on. 15 more minutes. I want to tell a joke, actually. I don't have nearly so good a joke as the Noah joke. I didn't speak to Noah. I spoke to Anderson. Last night, actually it was two nights ago in the car, and I asked, wouldn't it be a great idea to encourage our experimental friends to look harder at order, look harder for different kinds of order in the cuprates, because that Steve's pushing on stripes seemed to have been so successful in moving the field forward. And Phil thought a minute and said, no. He said it was a trap, because if you told them to look, they might find something. Now, that is a wonderful, wonderful title, I think, for the conference as a whole and the workshop that it's supposed to engender. That is, it has come to pass that the original ideas many of us had about what the problem was weren't right. And that's the toughest thing in theoretical physics, to rethink one's most basic beliefs about what is important and what one is trying to accomplish. Phil is not here to defend himself, so it's not really fair, but he really meant what he said. He believes that the different kinds of order that one finds in the cuprates are epiphenomena and not relevant to the true truth, which is a new phase. New phase revealed by the strange transport, the strange phenomenology of the cuprates. And I guess the message I want to implant here is, I hope, is that we can perhaps question the truth of that assumption. Because it leads down a different path, and sort of by diffusion, in the sociology of physics, we have been diffusing in this direction already for the past several years. If we look at the experimental successes that have really turned heads, and the things that have really mattered, they've all revolved around order in some way or another. Not just superconducting order, magnetic order, mechanical distortions. We're talking now about current, bond current magnetism, and so forth. Now, this is true, it's objectively true, and I suggest you should all sort of think why. Why did this happen? Why has it turned out the stripe idea has been so powerful in this subject? Part of the answer is that it's right. But there's another reason too, which was that the experimental dichotomy provided by order is clean. When we are in an environment where nothing is clear and we have Alice in Wonderland boundary conditions, things change every day, all of us look for things to grasp, things to hold on that we know are true. The dogma that there is a new phase was, at the beginning, at least my rock to stand on. But it melted away, and in my own career, I've looked for other things to hang on to get orientation in the subject. And the thing which has succeeded, at least in my mind, is establishment of order. The reason is because order is a neat thing. Either it's there or it isn't. And so you can make a clean distinction and a clean dichotomy between, and know that you have understood something.
Here, here.
Now, there is, however, a further implication of the question of order, and that is becoming more and more clear implicitly as we learn more and more about the materials. There are lots of different kinds of order. We know this to be true, and they're competing, and they come and go, and they are there if you make the sample one way and not there if you make the sample in the other way. In other words, there is something wrong in disagreement with nature that we had assumed at the very beginning of this discussion, namely that the superconducting state had a large basin of attraction, and therefore any old modeling procedure would lead to an understanding of superconductivity. It's as plain as the nose on your face that if you are faced with many phases delicately balanced, then it is difficult to tell which one you have got from first principles. It is not possible to take a Hamiltonian that is 100% wrong and get the right phase. So we have learned that there's a multiplicity of phases in the materials. We have learned that there's a multiplicity of phases in the models. This knowledge was obtained at great cost in both cases. I'd say that the numerical people have, theorists are the real heroes in this discussion. We people were working more phenomenologically, rather arrogantly assumed that there was only one truth, and what they showed is that if you're careful, you find the emergence of many different phases all fighting with each other and competing. Now, this fact has implications. It's both an experimental fact and a computational fact. The implication that matters to me mostly is that the link, the logical link between the microscopic equations and the ordering phenomenon you're trying to understand has been broken. What makes a model problem computable, what makes it able to describe reality, is the fact that it doesn't make mistakes. But if we have a close proximity of many phases, then the basic idea of going deductively from models to order isn't right. It's fundamentally not right. A few days ago, I made a joke about this nightmare of trying to be as smart as John Bardeen and not succeeding. It's true, and I've thought a lot about this. Why not succeeding? Well, of course, the reason is that I'm not as smart as John Bardeen, but also that's the last war. The problem of demonstrating that superfluid order, symmetry breaking, could exist was the last war. That was the war that was the battle that was fought and won by BCNS. Our war is a different one, not to show that new kinds of symmetry breaking are there, but to understand which kinds you've got and how they emerge out of the laws of quantum mechanics. Now, Phil's desire to see a new phase, not to see new kinds of order, belies a terrible prejudice and also a blindness to something else that is related. That is, we know that phase transitions exhibit universality. And unfortunately, there aren't very many zero temperature phase transitions known to science that aren't corrupted by dirt or first order. But we certainly know from our colleagues in particle physics that second order phase transitions should exhibit lots and lots of universality. And if that were happening in the cuprates, it would mean that all the measurements are telling you about this universality and not about which phases you're about to go into or what the microscopic Hamiltonian was. In other words, in the case of BCS, detailed comparisons with experiment would tell you about the superconducting phase. Here we're facing the possibility that detailed comparisons with experiment are telling you about some critical point that is nearby and which is causing all the behavior to be simple and universal and irrelevant to anything. Now, I don't know if that's true, but the fact that we have multiplicities of phases suggests that it might be so. And this, I think, is at the root of Phil's remark that he doesn't want to see the order appear. Because the appearance of that order has the rather ugly implication from his point of view that maybe the RBB is a critical phenomenon and not central at all. Now, so I say in the time of crisis that we're in right now, we have to face up to the deductive path from microscopics that we're all grown up, brought up to know and use. Maybe it's not going to work in this case, and that the first order of business is to make good phenomenology with as few moving parts as possible in order to motivate experiments to find phases. Why find phases? Because they are concrete fiducials. Once we have found order and we stop having discussions about minutiae, and we move on with solid knowledge of what is and is not true. Now, what I've just remarked is basically echoed in the previous talks. I'm hoping here to focus a little bit onto the fundamental questions having to do with epistemology and science, what you can and cannot know, and how we gain an understanding of nature in physics through experiment. So I think the search for new phases is what this field is all about now. Even if the new phases come and go with small modifications of sample preparation technology, the implicit assumption that the superconductivity must be robust or the phenomenon must be robust in order to be real, I think is not true if you have competition among phases. One should instead be on the lookout for phases that pop in and out of existence depending on how you make the sample. And one should look for the exceptions to the rules rather than the agreements with the rules themselves. This field is full of such stuff, and I believe that it is part of the job of the theorists to help identify and sort out these phenomena, to help us understand what the phase diagram is, and therefore to help us understand if there is a new kind of universality that is fooling us into thinking we are getting closer to the problem than in fact we aren't. Now, so that means I think mostly the role of theoretical physics now in this problem is not modeling, but is handshaking with experiments in the simplest possible way. And when we're prototyping phases, we want to prototype them in the simplest possible way, not the most complicated possible way. Thus, if I'm explaining a D-wave superconductor to somebody, I will write down a BCS equation because it's the simplest prototype of the phase. As far as I know, there is no evidence that the state of matter that we have in a D-wave superconductor is any different from conventional BCS. Now, I had also a conversation with Steve Killison the other night who remarked that he'd been rereading Thomas Kuhn's book about paradigms of science, about how paradigm shifts in science are always presaged by bitter disagreements among factions, and people cannot agree with each other even about what the problem is. And then what historically happens is that one of the disparate points of view becomes strong and eventually supplants the other. Now, we have two paradigms at work now, and perhaps a third. The first is what I would call the deductive path paradigm, which is we start with the equations of solid-state physics, which are known, and compute, and deductively get the answer. The second is the phenomenology paradigm, where we look for macroscopic organization in matter. We look specifically for new phases, and we enumerate them. And once we've understood what they are, then we understand their low energy properties and the low energy properties of the transitions between them. There is a third possibility, which is new, which is implicit in the Stripe idea, namely the idea of hierarchical organization such as one has in the life sciences, where instead of looking for old, looking in nature for the principles of organization you know, we are on the lookout for new ones that involve first organizations on, let's say, the 100 angstrom scale, and then higher. As of this moment, there are no such principles of organization known. Therefore, insofar as that is legitimate third paradigm, we need, in my view, to focus on how one would prove it experimentally. Right now, the experimental confrontations are with minutiae, which is the modeling paradigm, and with phase diagrams, which is the phenomenology paradigm. Now, I personally think that it's the latter is going to win. But it's just a guess. Like Patrick, I am enthusiastic, but I do not agree with him that the answer is the survival of the deductive path paradigm that we're trained with the students. I think ITC is its death knell, actually, and that the way it'll turn out is that we will have been humbled and had to jettison all that hubris. I certainly don't think there's any evidence that gauge theory is a computational technology in solid-state physics. I do think it's a tremendously interesting question about whether gauge can be inverted from, that is to say, that you might be able to draw physical analogies between organization you see in matter at people-scale physics and organization in matter you see in the universe. But as a technological thing, my own guess is that it's failed. So I hope that y'all can think about what we've learned at this conference, the extremely large philosophical issues at stake, the real sociological problem of dealing with experiment in a way that's productive, and use the workshop as a way to make a major breakthrough in the field. That's all I have to say.
A lot of what you're saying I really agree with, except I think that some of us were not brought up on the belief in the hard deductive path. Kind of felt all along that those physical systems that we have a prayer of understanding well are those in which there's something qualitatively new going on, something universal going on. And I think I believe all along that we're fooling ourselves if we think we can really reliably go from microscopic equations in a predictive way to macroscopic reality. I think in the cuprates, in my opinion, the important question is the devil in the details, and it's not new physics, it's just old phases that we've seen before competing in some very complicated way, in which case I view it as very hopeless, or is there something qualitatively new hidden there, and qualitatively new,
right,
that we can identify?
Yeah, I agree. And this was, of course, why so many of us got fired up by the RVB when Phil invented it, because we thought it was a possibility of a brand new state of matter. Now, I've come over to the other side now. That as of this moment, my best guess is that it's a non-existent state of matter, and that the phenomena it allegedly describes are critical phenomena. However, before we get off the subject, Doug made a great point. It is very easy when you're making phenomenology to say things that don't make any sense. And I certainly try to stick to the discipline of writing down simple prototypes for the proposals that I make in terms of electron coordinates. In other words, we don't really know what the properties of these new phases are. We don't even know if they exist. So we're trying to invent them. And the best way to invent something that's right is to be disciplined about making it as simple as possible and making it as explicit as possible and finding the simplest imaginable prototype for the phase. And my example of that was a BCS theory. We can make other theories that have a D-wave node in them, for example. I'm guilty of it myself. But in the end of the day, if the low energy spectrum is the same as BCS, the right thing to do is to fess up, throw the model out, and say, this is BCS, here's how you test it.
The BCS theory for classical superconductors is a prime example and tells us that it is for reductive growth.
Absolutely it is. And
you can calculate their incredible detail.
It's true. It's Morris's point is exactly true. And this is why I say I've been back and forth on this myself. And this is what I fear is an example of fighting the last war. Of course, BCS was trying to do something that much harder than what we're trying to do. They were trying to identify what continuous broken symmetry was, which in those days we didn't understand. So they had a qualitatively new state of matter to write down. Thus far, as far as I know, the symmetry breakings that we know about, the phases that we know about at zero temperature, are all conventional. Now, of course, all of us have an open mind about this. The point is, in order to demonstrate that you have a new phase, you have to prove it experimentally. So I'm, indeed, BCS is an example of the deductive path, but BCS lucked out. And it might just turn out that this is not that kind of problem.
One last question.
Is it just look for a new order to true on the order? There is this order sometimes you can undefine it, like the difference to not what we find in this order.
Right, so Eugene says, what do you do about this order? This is a real problem in the cuprates. I have basically one answer. I've been round and round on this problem. I think my own view is that going after order is the only game in town, and we just have to hammer on the gates of our government, more importantly the government of Japan, to keep those samples improved. Okay? And I spend, precisely for this reason, an inordinate amount of my personal time on the road proselytizing for good materials, high quality, people, that's not high quality growers, good grower budgets, good materials. Don't believe materials are good until you've actually seen their properties. So that's the best answer I can give you. I think the active way to go about this problem is not to whine about it, but to get those samples improved.
Earlier in this meeting, you raised a very important question that you failed to add to our list here. So I'll do it for you, because it was a good question. You don't recall it probably. It was, whatever happened to yes and no?
Huh. Well, I did mention this. When I say the problems of the moment are phases, that's because they are yes-no questions. They're not gray questions. They're high contrast questions. So yes, it's because of the importance of yes and no that I think the questions of what are the phases are the key ones right now.
Because that's what threads right through this, like Doug's
yes.
Coming.
And Doug,
when do you abandon your approach? That's
okay.
What is the yes or no question?
Exactly.
That has to be asked.
And so the discipline that will help us move forward is to state concretely falsifiable questions and draw a line in the sand and take a stand on what you think the answer of a thing must be. And unfortunately, you know, it's very painful to do because in high PC, of course, one is wrong 90% of the time. But all I can tell you is it's my experience, the only way to get an experimentalist to do what I want is to give him a chance to embarrass me in public. And I think all of you ought to do the same thing.
There's a famous quote by Rutherford to the effect that, or at least at the time, that all science was either physics or stamp collecting. Now, supposing that we succeed in this program of identifying all the phases or types of order, but we don't understand in the conventional sense where they come from, then have we succeeded in physics or in stamp collecting?
Great question. We know there are universal behaviors around in this problem, okay? But what we don't know is where they come from. So will we find, okay, now, solid state physics is different from particle physics. We know the Hamiltonian, okay? So finding out the equations of motion is not the problem. And I suppose what we're discussing right now is what is the problem. many of us, Matthew disagreed, but certainly my upbringing was, you find the path. You find the deductive path from the equations to the behavior. It might turn out that this is a case where it's impossible. Now, if you find a physical reason why one of your preconceptions about nature was wrong, I don't think that's Stan Pelletier. I think that's profoundly important.
One last thing. You mentioned Bardeen. So what did you do? You identified the key thing, the energy gap, and then you came up with a theory.
What's your question?
So we have to find the key. Maybe it's the pseudo gap. Maybe it's something else. You have the key.
Well, Mike,
almost philosophizing and go away.
Mike, I don't think this problem is going to resolve the BCS problem. I just don't. I think it's a different kind of problem, and I think it's a tremendous blindness and myopia to assume that the solution will be like BCS and use that as a paradigm in light of all the facts that say otherwise. The right thing to do is step away from the problem and ask, what is it? 10 years of hard work by very, very smart people with so little progress should tell you that maybe that idea isn't right somehow. There's something new that we have to synthesize as a theory community to help move forward. Okay, there are no more.
Thank you.